last night we heard from Subhajamati talking about Shraddha, which is, well, in the way that we're doing it, which is the first of the these sort of vital qualities of mind that we're calling them, qualities of mind that the Buddha talked about explicitly, but qualities of mind that we need to live a vital, engaged spiritual life, or even a life. If we had these qualities alive in our life, they'd do us a lot of good. So tonight we'll move on to the second quality. So I want to start off with an image, maybe a good way of starting talking about it is, it's an image that all of us have walked past tonight. Probably some of us who live here and work here have walked past it hundreds of times in the last few days, probably. It's an image that probably none of us will ever see. I've never seen it. Some of us in the room probably have seen it. But it's a huge image. And it's quite close to where we are now. But we'll never see it. But it's definitely there. And it plays a significant aspect in our life. Well, I'm not sure about that. Maybe after tonight it will, after I've explained to you. So the image is the image, because you can't see it, I'll need to explain it to you. I've never seen it, as it happens. I've only seen it in photographs, so I can only explain it secondhand. But the image is a huge image, maybe bigger than the height of this wall. And it's of a horse, beautiful, strong, energetic horse in the prime of its vitality, and it's got wings. It's a winged horse, and the horse, because it's got wings, it's completely transcended its usual pasture and grassy home, and has found its new life aloft, flying through the clouds, transcending itself. So that's the image. Has anyone seen it? Possibly. No. No one's seen it. Okay, none of us have seen it in this room. Have you seen it? Yeah, Subhajamati's seen it. Subhajamati's the only one in the room who has actually seen it. And it's actually beneath the lotuses. So you know the lotuses above the courtyard, the huge lotuses. Beneath that, there's this image of a huge flying horse. And Maitrebandhu and Abhayavajra painted over that image, and now we've got the lotuses. But I think it's important that we recall the significance of that image. And I am going to try and speak about that, or certainly use that image. So you've got this image of a horse. A horse is often used as an image of energy, isn't it? Horses are very strong, powerful, energetic creatures. But of course, this horse has got wings, so it's energy that can transcend itself, if you see what I mean, transcend its conditions. A normal horse just stays in fields, eating grass and running around. But this horse transcends all of that. It's a transcendental horse. So it's an image for transcendental energy. Yeah, that's what we're exploring tonight. And so the Buddhist conception of energy is not just energy. The Buddhist quality of energy, the quality of mind that the Buddha talks about when he talks about energy, is energy that is able to transcend itself. And that one description of it is energy in pursuit of the good. So you could, you know, the good is usually referred to as enlightenment for the sake of all beings, for the benefit of the world. That's what good means. So this is a huge ideal. Like, it's the biggest ideal you can think about. Energy in pursuit of enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Yeah, so it's incredibly big ideal. It's the biggest ideal I've ever come across. enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. So there are other ideals, of course, in the world, and there were other very, very good ideals, like equality, disarmament, etc., etc. But this is a bigger ideal than those. It's the most important ideal, enlightenment for the sake of all beings. So this is the Buddhist sort of conception of what energy is. I'm going to go and explain it in a minute. But, you know, it's quite odd, isn't it, energy? It's quite difficult to explain. I'm sure science has got an answer, but I wouldn't understand it. But, like, we've got energy, haven't we? Somehow we've got energy. It's a bit difficult to really get a hold on. It's a bit difficult to really know what energy is anyway. I mean, like, you know, there's lights in the room, that's coming out of energy. Energy is making light. Energy makes heat. Energy creates movement. We've got some of those, and most of us don't project light, but we've got energy, haven't we? We've got this kind of quality of energy. It's alive in us. You could even say that it's very, very, you could even say it's life itself. If you didn't have energy, if you didn't have any energy, you wouldn't be alive. So we've got this incredible sort of quality of aliveness that is like happening all the time, even if we're completely exhausted, we've still got this quality of energy. But the Buddhist conception is energy that's directed to the good. So let's start off with what might be the opposite of that to begin with, because we're probably a little bit more used to that. So energy that isn't directed to the good, basically. Energy that isn't directed to the benefit of all beings. That's the opposite of energy in the Buddhist sense of things. So it's sort of energy directed towards, you could say the bad, but you could also say the unskillful. And you could say it's energy directed not to anyone apart from yourself. And we have that energy, don't we, as well? We have that. We use our energy in those ways. And a Buddhist would say, well, that's very, very lazy. It's very, very lazy. You can be very, very active, doing lots and lots of active, busy, good things in the world. But if your energy is solely for yourself and through your activity you're cultivating negative mental states like anxiety or aversion or frustration, etc., etc., ill will, then a Buddhist would say, well, that's lazy. It's a lazy way of being. Which is rather sobering, isn't it? Because we can we can lead very busy, active lives, but lives that are orientated towards getting into rather dark, fractious moods where we feel depleted and rather fed up. And from a Buddhist perspective, that's laziness. It's laziness. Some of what I'll say in my talk comes out of a piece of work by someone called Shantideva, and he was a Buddhist, a Buddhist student or something in a university, and the university was called Nalanda in India, about 600 or 700 AD, something like that. And he was seen to be really lazy. All the other students just saw him as really, really lazy. He just seemed to kind of sleep in the day, didn't really do anything apart from lie around and eat and defecate and just kind of apparently be a bit of a slob. And they you know, they the other students just got fed up with Shantideva, and they wanted to, in a way, sort of humiliate him and show him up for what he really is, like a lazy, good for nothing. So they invited him to talk about the Dharma in the university, and, you know, do a public presentation on the Dharma. And of course, they were, you know, they were looking forward to bringing him down and, you know, sort of humiliating him, really. And what they did was they built quite a high seat, and so that he would, so that it was too high for him to get up to, and to sort of indicate his sort of lack of authority, in a sense, lack of spiritual maturity. Anyway, he was able to bring the seat down with his hand, and he got onto the seat and he said, would you like me to talk about something new, or would you like to talk me to talk about teachings that have been heard before? And so they saw their opportunity and thought, we'd like you to speak about something new, thinking that this would lead to a greater humiliation. And what happened was that he expounded an incredibly profound, broad, deep teaching of the Dharma. It's like a work of most incredible poetry when you read it. It's quite long. It's in 8 or 10 chapters, and it depicts a whole path, a whole vision of the spiritual life. And of course, you know, they realised that he wasn't, you know, of course he wasn't lazy at all. I'll say what happens a little bit later. But our view of what's lazy and what's energetic can be quite dependent on the social world that we live in. But from a Buddhist point of view, if what you're doing is leading to negative mental states, you're acting lazily. It's rather sobering, isn't it? Because I work in a Buddhist centre, and I can busy myself with lots of good activity and still get into negative mental states. So anyway, moving on. So even if we have got, you know, even if we have got high ideals, many of us have high ideals, it's still not easy to live them out, is it? It's still not always possible to sort of get them alive in our life, even, you know, when you try and, you know, it can be like really hard, can't it? You know, you come to the Buddhist Center, you do the metta bath, no, it's great. You think, yeah, this is great. I really want more metta in my life. And it's really hard. Like, you just get in a mood on the tube and like, oh, why can't I do it? Well, I mean, in one way, Singha Manas and I were talking today, in a way, life is quite challenging, isn't it? The demands of the modern life, demands of modern living, especially in London, are pretty hard. You've got to do a lot of work to make enough money to pay fairly high rents. And then when you've done that, you've got to, you know, just getting food and stuff. It's a lot, you know. You've got to work hard. So anyway, even so, I can't remember what I was going to say. Anyway, I thought that was a good point. A general sympathetic point. But that might not always be the reason why we find it hard to practice the spiritual life. Working hard, paying the rent, etc., might not be the reason why we find it hard to develop metta. There are other reasons, and I want to just explore some of those. Yes. So, sorry, I'm slightly losing myself. I guess sometimes we can just feel like we just haven't got enough energy to meditate. You know, we get to the centre, we feel tired, haven't got enough energy, can hardly keep awake in the meditation. We sort of, you know, snooze in the first half and then have tea, and then someone gives a talk in the second half, and maybe there's a bit of meditation where we get to somewhere, and then we go home, and then we've got to get up the next day and go to work. But it's not always that we're tired from external activity, although it can be. It can also be that we're that our energy, our natural energy that we have that is available to us, has become blocked in some way. I think it's very, very easy to block our energy, and particularly actually in today's society. I think, maybe in all societies, maybe when there's always a society with social norms and cultures, then perhaps we feel that we need to adhere to those norms and cultures and behaviours in certain ways, and then we inhibit ourselves in particular ways, and therefore maybe we always find ourselves in situations where we block our energy. But, you know, we can block our energy by repressing our emotions, can't we? So if you're, you know, depending on how you've been brought up, you might feel unconsciously that you shouldn't express certain emotions, like you shouldn't express anger or something. If you express anger, that's very, very bad, and you shouldn't do it, and you'll get told off if you do. I've certainly felt that in my life. I've certainly found it difficult to express some emotions, partly due to, you know, just circumstance. But particularly more socially unpleasant emotions like aggression, for example. We've all got aggression. We can all be aggressive. How do we find ways of expressing that in a creative way? Maybe it's more particularly pertinent for guys. How do you get access to that energy and emotion in a skillful way? But particularly in quite a PC society, we need to be careful not to block ourselves off, not to block our emotions, because our emotions contain our energy. And of course, there are other conditions that aren't conducive to energetic expression. So, like, I was in a building society the other day, and I'd gone in to do something, gone in to transfer some money, and I thought it was pretty weird atmosphere. It seemed like no one really wanted to do anything, so there was quite a long queue going up to the counter, and the people in the booths behind the queue, they were kind of quite friendly in a way, but it seemed like they didn't really want to help in a funny, weird way. I couldn't quite understand it. I was just watching this guy. He'd obviously a bit late for work. He got in and he came round. I could see him. He was sort of sweating and came round, sort of started switching his machine on. You know, there's a queue of people already grumbling. I even found myself grumbling, like. And, just came on and switched on his machine and logged on. It took him ages, you know. I just thought he just looked really unhappy. And I really felt like I wanted to go and speak to him and just be friendly. When the thing came up on the digital display, I had to go to someone else. I really felt it's not a very, very positive environment. The ideals here in this institution are very, very low. They're very, very low. In fact, this is linked to another bit of wasting energy. There were a couple of guys stood by the queue, and they were kind of jollying each other along in a sort of a jolly way. So they looked quite jolly, but what they were talking about was like Tower Bridge is closed to traffic for a few months or something while they're doing some work on it. So there's all these deviations around Tower Bridge, and there's loads of traffic jams everywhere. And these two guys who I took to be, I don't know, just like workers going around fixing things or something. I don't know what they were doing. But they were obviously in Halifax. Oops, I shouldn't have said Halifax. Anyway. Anyway, they were in the building society fixing something, waiting for their security to be cleared so they could get behind this window and go and fix whatever it was. And they were just talking about, sort of moaning about all the traffic jams that were happening because London Bridge was closed. And I was just listening to them, and they were quite sort of, in a funny sort of way, quite happy. Well, they seemed to be, but everything they were saying was negative. Everything was a problem. It was all a problem. The whole transport system was a problem. Everything that they experienced in their cars or vans on the road was problematic everywhere they went. And but they were quite happily chatting away. And I just thought, well, this is quite negative, actually. It's quite negative. And when I was reading, this about energy, you know, I just thought, God, what a waste of energy. What a waste of energy. All that vital, energetic life is going on moaning. And I think that's pretty common. I think it's pretty common to have a moan about life, isn't it? Moan about the government, moan about the boss, moan about the management, moan about the transport, moan about the tubes. It's pretty common. And probably we don't notice it because most people are doing it. Even the news can sometimes be a bit of a moan. Facebook can be a series of people having a moan about things. You know, life shouldn't be like this. Politics shouldn't be like that. People shouldn't be like that. It's permeated our society where we can't even see it. But from the Buddhist point of view, it's a waste of energy. And if you feel tired, if you come to the Buddhist center and you can't meditate, it might be because you've spent the day moaning. It might be because of that. I don't know. It might be because you're working hard to pay the rent, but it might not be that. So this is ways that we can this is ways that we can block our energy or waste it. Yeah, we can block our energy or waste it. Crikey, I can hardly think. And of course, our negative speech, our moaning speech, negative speech comes out of negative emotion. And negative emotion, from a Buddhist point of view, is a waste of energy. When you get anxious, you're wasting your energy. When you get into ill will or aversion, you're wasting your energy. When you distract yourself through craving, you're wasting your energy. You're putting your energy into things that can't, it doesn't give you very much good return on your input, if you see what I mean. You can put your energy into much, much better things, and you'll get a much, much better return on your input. But putting your energy into anxiety, moaning, irritation at things, craving, distraction, we all do it, we all love it, but it's a waste of energy. And if you get to the cushion and you can't meditate because you feel tired, it might be because you've been doing some of that. And it's very, very common, and it's completely normal, if you see what I mean. It's completely normal. We all do it. But from the Buddhist point of view, well, you're not going to become a strong, vital, airborne horse through moaning about the tube. So there are antidotes to these things. Yeah. So if your energy is blocked, if you find it hard to express yourself, and find it hard to express emotions, you need to find a way of coming into real communication. I can remember coming first to the London Buddhist Centre, and they still do, actually we still do, but on that night, it was a Wednesday evening, Maitreya Bandhu was leading communication exercises. Some of you have done them, where you just sit opposite someone else in the room, like a complete stranger, and you sit quietly with your eyes open and you just look at them, and they look at you and you don't speak. And I did it with Maitreya Bandhu, who I didn't know, and I was pretty terrified because he had a queso on and I had to look at him and he was looking at me, and we didn't speak, and it was both utterly excruciating and utterly liberating, because I found it such a relief that I could just look at someone and someone could look at me. And it was like a basic practice of how you communicate. And it's really, really stood me in good stead. And there's lots of people around the Buddhist Centre who are willing to enter into vibrant, vital communication. And I feel I've benefited a great deal from my contact with people in the Sangha, and found new ways, and just some ways, to be less inhibited and express myself more fully so that my energy is much less blocked. I've been able to do that through communication. So that's one antidote to unblocking energy. An antidote to wasting energy, i.e. negative emotion or negative speech, is basically quite simple. You cultivate the opposite. Yeah, if you're getting in a bad mood, cultivate metta. If you're speaking, if you get into moaning, just develop awareness and stop doing it. I know it sounds easy and I know it's really hard, but that's what we have to do. That's the antidote to wasting energy. You cultivate the opposite. And the other thing is that often we can't meditate, it's because our energy is too coarse, because we've been using our energy to get involved in coarse, kind of gross things, you know, like just stuff, like daily stuff, the stuff of life, or daily life, if you see what I mean. It's not actually the stuff of life, but you know, the blockbuster movies, the slightly violent videos on Facebook, the news can be quite kind of gross in that sense. Those sorts of things, and it's easy to indulge in that sort of slightly violent or sexual films. Very, very easy to just take that as our diet, if you see what I mean. And then we come to meditation, say, and that requires a much more subtle awareness. To be aware of the breath, you need a much more subtle awareness. And, that needs to be developed. So an antidote to that is just to reduce some of the input that you have, which I know some of you are doing this week on the Urban Retreat. But also, you can refine your input. So just do other things, like, you know, I've been walking around the park, you know, 5 o'clock or so, in the afternoons, and it's really, really beautiful. It's really beautiful. Just the particular light at this time of year. Dougie was talking about it earlier, and it's just really beautiful. And you just have a different sort of input. You're all aware of this, but you just enjoy the light of the sun or the light on the water. And you have input, but it's different, it's more subtle, and it creates a different sort of awareness. So when you come to meditate, your awareness is already a bit more refined than it was if you just switched off your phone looking at the latest Facebook feed or whatever. And of course the arts can also, refine the mind, so that our energy isn't so coarse, yeah, so that we've got it available and we can engage in meditation. Okay, so that's something about how to like work with energy in our daily life. There are other ways of working with energies, and I just want to touch on those. So another way, or a way as well, of working with energy is that we need to kind of like get our basic emotions, our basic fundamental emotions that make up who we are, and get them onto the spiritual life or onto the path, if you see what I mean. So for example, you know, just desire. We have desire, we all have desire. Desire isn't necessarily a bad or a good thing. It's not necessarily anything to be eradicated or increased. But we can get it onto the spiritual life. We can cultivate a desire that is just like the desire for chocolate or a good night out, but it's for meditation or for being a better person or for cultivating ethics or for deepening friendships. You can cultivate that desire. And it's the same force, if you see what I mean. It's the same energy. It's just in a new form. I was thinking about pride as well. We all have pride, don't we? And usually we take our pride, sort of gets hooked on negative things. Like, I was just reading a book, at the moment about the River Thames. It's by Peter Ackroyd, like a biography of the River Thames. And there's a bit on it about the building of the, you know, the docks in London, which I knew nothing about, of course. And, you know, all these docks, and we know them because we go there, like where Canary Wharf is, I can't remember what it's called, but like West India Quay, Royal Victoria Dock. There's loads of docks. There's a period of intense dock building activity, and they built huge docks in London, like world-renowned docks. They were enormous. And of course, that meant that we could trade very, very easily. We had the capacity to take in big ships and trade very easily. Of course, we're living off the benefits, probably, of some of that trade. But of course, the docks were the pride of Britain, weren't they? They were what made Britain great at that time in the 19th century. And I was just reading these passages and written, I can't remember when they were written, but sort of taking pride in the size of the dock. So West India Dock was able to store 7,800 gallons of rum. Apparently that was enough to get the whole of Britain drunk at the time. And you know, like there were other things, like they could store enough sugar to make the whole of the Thames sweet, and they could store 28 million pounds worth of tobacco, 51 million pounds worth of tea. These are all in like buildings near the docks, like millions of gallons of wine they could store. They could just store it. And this is before shipping containers, yeah? So we live in a world now where the shipping containers, so you don't need warehouses near docks. They just come in boxes, get unloaded, and then put on lorries. But at that time, you needed huge warehouses storing all this stuff. But they also stored things like elephant tusks and mammoth tusks, you know. And of course, they were taking pride in this at that time. Look how good this is. And looking back now, of course, it's obscene. You know, it's obscene, isn't it? That we could so gladly store things like hundreds and hundreds of elephant tusks. I mean, it's despicable, really. But at the time, of course, we took pride in it. I do that, though. Like, you know, I used to I definitely used to get into boasting about how much I used to drink, like comparing with my friends that I drank more pints than them, or I had a double shot of vodka and they didn't, and I was still standing. That's pride in really, really negative behaviour. I'm glad to say that that sort of behaviour is now beneath me. So that's good. Yeah, so that's good. We can cultivate that sort of pride where we can look at our life and we can say, actually, I don't want to do that anymore. It's beneath me. That sort of behaviour is beneath me. And we can do that, and we can take pride in the development of positive mental states and slowly grow so that negative mental states we can feel are beneath us. We don't want to do them anymore. Yeah, we take pride in that. So we can take pride onto the path, but we have to look at what we've got pride in at the moment. And then things like ambition. Ambition can be very, very good, can't it? But we can take the ambition that we normally have for a career and for wealth and for accumulation and for whatever it is we have ambition in and take it onto the path. We can be ambitious about our spiritual life. We can challenge ourselves about the spiritual life. We can even develop the sort of attitude that wants to have a fight with our defilements. This is the language that's sometimes used, that we take on a warrior attitude, that we find that we want to actually challenge hatred within ourselves. We want to do that. It's a challenge. It's an ambition of ours to defeat hatred. We make it difficult for negative emotions to rule our mind. Yeah, that's a way of working, and it's using the qualities that we normally have, like ambition, which is in a way a natural wish for growth, but we use it in a skillful way. And we can cultivate enjoyment. Everyone needs to enjoy themselves. Enjoyment is a very, very positive things have in our lives. If we didn't enjoy ourselves, it would be terrible. We need enjoyment. Humans need enjoyment. We can cultivate enjoyment in the path, in the practices. I'm sure Singha Manas will talk about enjoying deep, quiet mental states in meditation. You can cultivate an enjoyment of those sorts of mental states. Just like we enjoy other things in life. Do you see what I mean? So we're using that kind of makeup that we have and bringing it onto the path. So we can do that with desire and pride and ambition and enjoyment and other sorts of states. But hopefully that gives you a taste of ways of working. And in this way, our energy starts to become less and less embroiled in busy, lazy activity. And we can start to bring our energy into our meditation. The image that is used to describe what this looks like is a male elephant. I don't know quite why it's male. Maybe it's on heat, but anyway, it's a male elephant jumping into a pool of lotuses, really, really enjoying squirting water all over himself, eating all the lotuses in one pool, and then jumping out of that pool straight into another with complete delight. Yeah, that's what our energy needs to be like when we come to meditation. Okay, so I hope I've given you a brief, it feels like a whirlwind anyway in here, but a brief whirlwind tour of energy, yeah, and how you can work with energy. If you can do this, if you can both find ways of not allowing negative emotions to dominate and waste your energy, and you can find ways of bringing your energy onto the path, then you will start to cultivate virya. And virya is energy that is linked to your ideals. And if your ideals are for the benefit of all beings, that means that your energy will be less and less caught up with solely yourself. Yeah, it will be much more available to other people and situations. Your energy will be much more available for the good of the world, which of course includes yourself. And in this way, you'll be able to transcend your conditioning. You'll be able to transcend the forces of society, the forces in your own mind that limit you and keep you in the pasture with the grass, and you'll be able to lift off like a winged horse into the air. And just to finish back on that image, actually, I think it's quite appropriate, really, that underneath these lotuses there's this image of this horse. And it's like in our spiritual life, the image of the lotuses is the image of the spiritual life. The image of the lotuses is growth and development. It is what the spiritual life is. But behind that is energy. It's energy that makes the lotuses grow. It's energy that allows your life to grow out of the murky depths of the pond and emerge in full bloom, in full glory, above the surface of the water, completely free. And it's energy that's behind that, if you see what I mean. Energy makes that happen. So your entire growth and development is dependent on energy, just like the lotuses on that mural are on top of this beautiful image of a winged horse. Thank you very much.